From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Healthcare, politics, and the law. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Obama's health care reform is being implemented nationwide, even though federal judges disagree on a major provision. Is it constitutional to require healthy people to buy insurance even if they don't want to? Two judges say yes, one says no, and others are yet to be heard from. The issue probably will be resolved by a single justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, but will it make any difference? Would health care reform still go into effect without the mandate Republicans hate? Would support grow for the public option Democrats love? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the luxury markets are being transformed by the People's Republic. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Last spring, Congress passed health care reform, and the states are putting it into effect. But the battle continues in the political arena and in the courts. Are President Bush's judicial appointees changing constitutional law? Will Republican challenges to health care reform backfire in favor of the Democrats? On Reporter's Notebook, luxury goods are being snapped up in the U.S. and Europe by free spenders from China. First, this news update. They said it would never happen, but today the U.S. Senate passed a controversial bill on a bipartisan vote, 81-19, in favor of the tax cut and unemployment extension deal President Obama worked out with Republicans. David Lightman is national correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers. David, good to have you back on our program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
43 Democrats, 37 Republicans in favor of this bill. That sounds like bipartisanship.
44, yeah, I think, yeah,
44,
certainly
okay.
Was. No surprise, though. Not at all. What we're watching now, frankly, is that they voted for this bill that increases the deficit by an estimated $858 billion. Now they're going to pivot and turn to a spending bill for the rest of this fiscal year, which would add and cost something like $1.1 trillion.
So whatever happened to the deficit?
Well, that's right. What happened to all this concern about the deficit? You're going to hear a lot of talk about it, and now we'll see if they're ready to make the hard choices that they need to really get it going.
There's still an issue, though, with regard to this bill, which is that the House Democrats have indicated that they may oppose it. Here's what President Obama had to say just before the Senate acted, although you really had the feeling he was talking to Democrats in the House.
I know there are different aspects of this plan to which members of Congress on both sides of the aisle object. That's the nature of compromise. But we worked hard to negotiate an agreement that's a win for middle-class families and a win for our economy. And we can't afford to let it fall victim to either delay or defeat.
David Lightman, back to you with the McClatchy Newspapers. A lot of House Democrats don't see it that way.
No, they don't. They have several concerns, the foremost being the estate tax. This is a tax that would kick in on individual estates of over $5 million at a 35% rate. A lot of Democrats are up in arms about this. $68 billion over 10 years. They say, we already gave the wealthy the top two tax rates. Why do we need to give them this? They want it either scaled back or cut out entirely. Not the tax cut out, but brought back to the 55% level. There's some question whether they're going to get it. We should know in about 3-4 hours. There are all kinds of meetings going on, and I think we'll know a little more. My educated guess at the moment is there will not be changes because there's fear if there are, the Senate will never go along with it. So we'll see.
We're now speaking in mid-afternoon, Washington, D.C. time. Back to the issue of the omnibus spending bill that you mentioned before. Republicans want to push that off, I take it, until they have control of the House.
That's right. They'd rather do what they call a stopgap that would get them probably through February. And then in February, when Republicans have this enormous House majority, they'd consider it another stopgap measure to get them through. And the feeling is that stopgap would cut a lot of programs dear to Democrats.
And on the other hand, if you just continue spending at the current level, which is what's often done this year, then the makeup of the House changes, and so does everything else.
That's right. And you just continue spending at this level and fight the fight in the spring and summer. One way or the other, they're going to have to confront this deficit at some point in some form, whether it's this week, next month, or the spring. But it's going to happen, and then that begs the question, what's going to trigger the hard choices? I don't know.
What about the START treaty in the Senate? The president wants ratification ASAP, and the Republicans say there's not enough time to debate it.
Well, we'll know more in about, I think, 10 minutes at 2:15 the Eastern time. The Senate will come in and begin trying to proceed to the START treaty. Some are saying, some opponents or skeptics, I should say, are saying that they'll delay it by possibly reading the text of the START treaty on the floor. You're going to have all kinds of procedural maneuvering here. On the one hand, the feeling is that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid would not have brought the treaty up if he didn't have the 67 votes needed for ratification. On the other hand, opponents can do all kinds of things to tie this up and keep it going until New Year's Eve.
Another subject with regard to the spending bill has to do with earmarks. They're supposed to be eliminated, according to Tea Party doctrine, and yet there's a lot of earmarks in there, including a lot by Republicans.
Yeah, an estimated $8 billion worth, 6,600 earmarks, as is estimated by the watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense. It's going to be interesting to see if they get struck and what's going to happen here, because this is exactly the kind of thing that people voted against November 2nd. So there's a lot of hand-wringing going on right now about this.
So in the meantime, then, bipartisan vote today in the Senate on this bill, but the bipartisanship isn't going to last.
It doesn't look like it. Who knows in this environment? But I wouldn't take today's bill as the beginning of a trend. Maybe it is. But frankly, as I say, in a few hours, they're going to be on the START treaty. There's going to be a lot of rancor, and stay tuned.
David Liebman, as always, good to have you with us, national correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
In a moment, healthcare, politics, and the law on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. President Obama's health care reform requires that healthy Americans buy insurance even if they don't want to. Two federal judges in Virginia and Michigan have ruled that the so-called mandate is constitutional. They were appointed by Bill Clinton. This week, a third, also in Virginia, appointed by George W. Bush, ruled that it's not constitutional. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate.com, and it's always good to have you on our show.
Thank you, Warren.
Tell us how many more cases there are pending on this very matter.
They like to say dozens, but certainly the big one is going to be heard Thursday in Florida, and that is the case, that's the sort of other big one that is comprised of the Florida Attorney General and 19 other states' Attorney General. That's kind of known as the suit that Ken Cuccinelli, the Virginia AG, didn't join when he filed his own in Virginia. So the big one is going to be heard tomorrow in Florida. I guess I should add that the judge in that case has telegraphed that he's likely to lean the way Judge Hudson did here in this week's Virginia case. And then we're going to have one other just factoid, Warren, about that case. Just you've talked about the political affiliations of the judges in this case. 19 of the 20 attorney generals in the Florida suit are also Republicans. So this is really lining up to be not simply cases that are brought by Republican AGs, but that stand or fall based on the identity of the president who appointed the judge who hears them. So this is quite shaping up to be a very, very partisan legal issue.
And when you mentioned Judge Hudson in Virginia, he's the one who ruled most recently that the mandate, so-called, is unconstitutional. I know that your principal interest is in how President Bush has managed to change the nature of the courts, and I want to put that off for just a moment because another question arises first, and that is, if, in fact, the mandate is removed and found unconstitutional, does that mean health care itself collapses, health care reform, rather, even as it's being implemented all over the country?
You know, it's a sort of a health policy factual question. I've heard that question answered two ways in the past 2 days since this ruling came down. Certainly, Judge Hudson, in his ruling, said he was very careful to cabin his decision. He said, "I'm just going to strike down the individual mandate." He had been invited by the plaintiffs in the suit to do much more, to both strike down the entire statute and to enjoin the statute. He declined to do both of those things. So insofar as Cuccinelli prevailed, he prevailed in a fairly narrow sense. But then the question becomes, by gutting the individual mandate, do you in fact gut the entire law? There are health reform advocates who say not at all. This is actually great because there's other ways to go about keeping the rest of the law alive. There's others, including Judge Hudson, who say, look, this is the linchpin of the Obama health reform initiative. Without the individual mandate, the whole thing falls. So it's a health policy question more than a legal question, and one to which I confess I have yet to get a completely clear answer.
Dahlia Lithwick again, senior editor, legal correspondent for Slate.com. Ezra Klein is a columnist for The Washington Post and Newsweek magazine. It's good to have you on our show.
Hi.
Is there a clear answer to that question?
Dolly, you don't read the blog? I worry to say it's a bit complicated, but it is. What we basically know is this. Remember that the original Barack Obama campaign health care plan did not have an individual mandate. This is something that people attacked him for in the Democratic primary. But he believed, and other people believed, that you could do this without a mandate. You just can't do it as well. The best numbers we have basically say this. If you don't have an individual mandate, two things happen. Number one, fewer people get covered because healthy young people like me decide not to buy health care insurance because, you know what, I don't need it yet, and I can come in later and buy it then. So, well, number one, you don't have me covered. I'm uninsured. But number two, because I'm not covered, the average and people like me aren't covered, the rest of the pool is sicker. And when the rest of the pool is sicker, that means the average premium is higher. And that makes it, of course, less likely that I'm going to want to get covered until I'm sick because healthcare is more expensive. So what we think that'll do is basically reduce the number of people who would get covered by this bill from about 32 million to about 25 million. That's numbers out of a guy named an MIT health economist named John Gruber, who does a lot of this modeling. And probably the average premiums would go up. Now, one thing Dolly alludes to, which is true, is that there are other ways to design something that does approximately the same thing as an individual mandate, but has no relationship to the particular legal argument that Republicans are making, which is that this penalizes you for inaction. There are a lot of ways to do this, and we can go into them if you'd like, but basically the question there is, could you pass any of them? If Republicans wanted to sit down with Democrats and find another way to do the individual mandate in the bill, I'm sure they could. It wouldn't be that difficult. The question is, if they don't, if they say they will filibuster any attempt to improve Obamacare, then what happens is that Democrats can't put in any of those alternative options, and thus the bill sort of limps along without this piece of it. That may be an okay state of affairs, but it is definitely not preferable if you talk to the people who know this issue well.
What's the situation with regard to the health insurance industry, which initially was against health care reform, then got to be very much in favor of it because of the mandate?
They would not like it. I mean, the big losers out of this ruling were the healthcare insurers because, you know, a lot of liberals don't like the mandate. And conservatives, they actually used to like the mandate, but they don't like it anymore. But it's important to know why they used to like it. The individual mandate is a Republican idea. It emerged in the early 90s. It was part of the Republican alternative to Bill Clinton's healthcare plan. Bob Dole voted for it. Chuck Grassley was there on it. Orrin Hatch was on it. And it kept coming up. Mitt Romney's Republican plan in Massachusetts uses an individual mandate. The Wyden-Bennett plan used an individual mandate. And the reason you use an individual mandate is that it's really the only plausible way, or one of very few plausible ways, to have a universal health care system that includes private insurers. If you don't have an individual mandate, your capacity to do that is reduced. And so one of the options that becomes more attractive is going the government route. We know Medicare is constitutional. And so if we can't have an individual mandate and costs keep going up, when we need to do reforms, our ability to do reforms using the private market goes down. And if that goes down, then it becomes more and more likely that over time private insurers are squeezed out of healthcare as we create a Medicare for all system or some sort of Medicare-tied public option that everybody can buy into. One of the things that is true here is that in order to attack Barack Obama and his healthcare plan, Republicans are giving up on a policy that many of them believed in the long run was their real hope to stop a government, as they would call it, takeover of healthcare.
Ezra Klein, columnist for The Washington Post and Newsweek magazine. Enter David Sirota, nationally syndicated newspaper columnist, political strategist, host of a radio program on AM 760 in Denver, Colorado. Always good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're one who thinks, as Dahlia Lithwick put it, and as Ezra Klein just suggested as well, that this might be a new opportunity for the public option.
That's exactly right. That the individual mandate, of course, was campaigned against by Barack Obama in the 2008 Democratic primary, and that I think he was right to campaign against it. And I think that this may end up creating an incentive for the Senate, for the government, to move towards a public option. Right now, under existing budget rules, right now in this Congress, in this waning Congress, the Congress could pass a public option with 51 votes through reconciliation. So I think, unto itself, the court ruling doesn't solve the health care problem in this country, but it may bring us back to the place of the debate about a public option that we need to get to.
Healthcare industry, pretty important to Congress in many ways, particularly in terms of campaign contributions. They are really against the public option for obvious reasons. Do you really think it's feasible, particularly with the Republicans stronger than ever, that the public option now might have a better chance?
Well, I mean, look, time is running out in this Congress, and this Congress would be, of course, the best chance to pass it because those reconciliation rules are still around. You can still pass it with 51 votes. So I think you couple that with the court ruling, with the fact that the public option has been, every poll has shown it to be quite popular, I think there's always a chance. Do I think the insurance companies will fight tooth and nail against it? Absolutely. But I will say this. I think it's just important to note, as Ezra did note, that the insurers are the ones who are most upset with this court ruling. And so as much as it's been portrayed as some great loss for progressives or great loss for the Obama administration, although those two things may be different, the people who feel most upset about this court ruling are the insurance companies because they want state power to be used to guarantee them customers and therefore profits, therefore their centrality in the healthcare system.
Ezra Klein, back to you. Is there a diverse opinion as to what exactly the impact of the individual mandate is likely to be? What's actually happened in Massachusetts? Has it really worked?
It's not a very diverse set of opinion. If you have a structure of the type we're looking at in this health care bill, the individual mandate is pretty important, and Massachusetts is a great example why. So in about 1999, if I have my dates right here, Massachusetts creates a plan that has guaranteed issues, so you've got to be given health care, and community ratings, so pretty much everybody has to be given health care at the same price, but they don't have an individual mandate. And costs in that market, which is sort of the market of people who aren't getting health care from their employer or a public plan, skyrocket immediately. And Massachusetts becomes, for that reason, among others, very, very expensive. About 3 years ago, an individual mandate comes into effect in Massachusetts. And since then, under Romney's plan, since then, in that particular market where it has a role, costs have come down by 40%. 40. And that's as costs in that same market nationally have gone up by 14%. So I would separate these questions of public option and an individual mandate. I think David's right. We should have a public option. And I could actually see an argument that, this creates a further spur for Democrats to try to do that in reconciliation later on. But they also do have reason to worry that given the structure of the bill they've put into place, not having an individual mandate is going to create a problem where you have a lot of sick people signing up, which is what happened in Mass before you had an individual mandate. And that's going to raise prices and make the whole thing look less attractive and work less well. And that will discredit progressive solutions on health care reform as opposed to assuring the public that better ones are in the offing.
David Sirota, if the individual mandate brought down costs in Massachusetts by 40%, why wouldn't you be for it?
Well, I mean, there's a principled reason, and then there's a practical reason. I think the principled reason is that I don't think it's all that progressive to use state power to force people into the hands of private insurance companies without giving people at least an option for an entity which the public itself owns, or is at least the entity is accountable to the public. That is, I don't think it's right to use state power to force people exclusively into the hands of a private corporation without at least giving people a chance for a public option. I think the practical reason is also this, is that if you subscribe to that principle,
there's no guarantee that even with an individual mandate that the insurance companies aren't going to continue jacking up their premiums, right? I mean, it would be one thing if you could say to me, well, the insurance companies, we know, or they're guaranteed not to raise their premiums by a certain rate without the individual mandate. But there's no guarantee at all. And that was part of the compromise, so-called, on the health care bill, was that there really weren't tough price controls on premiums. Now, you've got state regulators in some states who can regulate or who have the ability to regulate prices in a more stringent way. But on the whole, we're relying on the promises or the goodwill of the private insurers to not raise premiums with an insurance mandate when they've shown every indication that they're going to jack those premiums anyway.
Back to Ezra Klein. How does this change the political calculation? The mandate, of course, is the least popular part of the health care reform, whereas other aspects of it, such as insurance companies can't reject you for pre-existing conditions, and there can't be caps, lifetime caps on insurance and so on, are extremely popular. Who's going to have the hardest time arguing now if the mandate goes away, the Democrats or the Republicans?
Very difficult to say until Anthony Kennedy makes his ruling. I mean, unless someone can go in sort of to his dreamscape, Inception style, and figure out what he thinks about this or tell him what to think about this, we just don't know how the politics are going to play out. There are two questions you're asking. One is what happens if the Supreme Court, with Anthony Kennedy, rules against the mandate and excises it from the bill. In that scenario, I don't really know what happens, and I don't think anybody else does either. But I probably would just muddle along. But the other scenario is a sort of more normal one that will happen one way or the other, which is the effort to repeal the bill or defund parts of the bill. And this is where things do get interesting, because the reason you have an individual mandate is in order to have a ban on insurers discriminating on pre-existing conditions. There is nothing in the bill, and virtually nothing in American politics, more popular than that particular provision. And when it does come down to it, and Republicans have to begin fighting about this and getting specific, they're going to quickly run up into that. They're going to have the opposite problem the Democrats have had with the bill, which is that once you're the guy arguing for something, or you're the party arguing for something, people begin to zoom in on the specifics of what they don't like that you're offering. And so just as Democrats found themselves having to defend the most unpopular parts of the bill they were trying to pass, Republicans are about to find themselves having to defend the most unpopular parts of what their repeal would do. And once they come up against that, I think the politics of this are going to get very difficult for them, which to some degree is why I expect them to largely try to duck this issue until 2012 or until at least the Supreme Court rules in one way or the other. I'm not sure Boehner and Cantor really want this as an actual thing they're trying to do, as opposed to something they just tell their base when it's convenient.
Top leaders of the Republican Party in the House, and now to be the Speaker and the Majority Leader. Very quickly, Ezra Klein, I know you have to go and we have to go to a break. Why Anthony Kennedy?
Because Anthony Kennedy is just going to be the swing vote. At the end of the day, what we've seen in these different court rulings is they've been very partisan. The Democrats have ruled one way, the Republicans have ruled the other way. We can pretty much expect that going forward, I think. And at that point, the person who is usually a swing in these sort of partisan rulings is Kennedy. He's traditionally had a very expansive view of the Commerce Clause, which is relevant here, but we just don't know what he's thinking now. And I think, as Dolly could say better than I, he's not always been a very consistent voice, which makes him erratic enough that everybody just sits around and watches what he does rather than tries to predict it.
We're going to take a break, as I indicated, then back to the court situation. In the meantime, Ezra Klein with the Washington Post and Newsweek, thanks a lot for being on our program. On Reporter's Notebook, Chinese consumers are changing the luxury markets and everything else. Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. We'll be right back.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, once again talking about health care reform now being implemented around the country as federal judges disagree about one of the major provisions. Some call it the most important provision, and that is the mandate that requires people to buy insurance, whether they want to or not, to buy a private product in the market. Jonathan Adler is professor of law and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University. He's a contributor to the National Review Online, contributing editor, I should say, and a regular contributor to the legal blog The Volok Conspiracy. Professor, good to have you on our show.
Good to be here.
It's been said several times on this program that there's a real political difference between the judges, and no accident that those who have ruled that the mandate is unconstitutional were appointed by Republicans, and that those who have ruled the other way have been reported appointed by Democrats. Do you agree that this is as much a political as it is a legal issue?
Well, I think it's political in the sense that judges appointed by different presidents, especially in the last couple decades, tend to have very different views about the nature of our constitutional structure, and in particular, the extent to which the Constitution limits federal power. And those judges that have been appointed by Republicans tend to are more likely to believe that the federal government is one of limited and enumerated powers and that it is up to judges to enforce those limits. And not those judges that have been nominated by Democratic presidents have tended to be more comfortable with the idea that the ultimate arbiter of the scope of federal power is not the courts, but Congress. And so that difference in vision is something that we see in the political process, and I think that really explains why conservative judges tend to be more skeptical of the individual mandate than more liberal ones.
Where do you come down on the recent decision by Judge Hudson in Virginia that the mandate is unconstitutional?
Well, I happen to think he's correct, but I also would say that it is an open question in the sense that the federal government has never sought to do something like this before. And as a result, we do not have existing precedents that are directly on point. That is to say, the federal government has never sought to, either as a use of its commerce power or as an adjunct to its commerce power, sought to force all Americans to purchase a governmentally approved product or service. And the question of whether or not that is either a regulation of commerce or a necessary and proper adjunct to a regulation of commerce has never been addressed. And we don't even have anything that's really close. We have things that are close enough that we can make arguments, but there is no controlling precedent. And so as a result, what ends up determining how people look at this question are the underlying premises they have about the nature of our constitutional structure, and in particular, what sorts of limits the federal government has. And that tends to be something that people of different ideologies tend to disagree upon quite strongly.
I don't want to get too deep into the legal weeds here, but there is some concern about whether Judge Hudson did a very good job of making his decision. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's a 40-page opinion or so. It's not comprehensive, as one of the other guests noted just a minute ago, talking about policy. You know, it's always easier to pick things apart and to find the holes and to find the problems than it is to articulate the overall or to create a policy. Or in this case, to write an opinion that is completely ironclad. There are aspects of the opinion that I might have done differently. But I think in terms of identifying the fundamental issues, I think that Judge Hudson took a very good swing at it. And you know, academics like me and others, we're gonna pick it apart and find areas where we would like to see greater discussion. Personally, I would have loved to see a more in-depth discussion of the necessary and proper clause, because that's the area where we have the least precedent, and it's also the legal question that I think ultimately this case will turn on if and when it gets to the Supreme Court.
Okay. Before we get to that point, how impartial is Judge Hudson? It's been reported that he owns a stake in a Republican consulting firm. He received tens of thousands of dollars from that company in dividends. It's called Campaign Solutions. And the clients include the Attorney General of Virginia, Ken Cuccinelli, who brought this case. Is that appropriate?
Well, I don't know enough about the specifics of Judge Hudson's investments, but typically the rule is judges should recuse themselves if they own a share of a company that is a party before a case. I'm not aware of any cases in which a judge was expected to recuse because they owned stock or owned a share of a company, a customer of which or a client of which was involved in a case. My understanding is that Attorney General Cuccinelli ended his contracts with the firm when he became aware of a potential conflict. But I'd need to know more about the specifics of the relationships to be able to say more than that.
Could be more a question of appearance than substance.
Yeah, and you know, I think the appearance rules themselves are important. But again, you know, if a judge owned a stock in a steel company, and there was a case involving General Motors, just because General Motors purchases a lot of steel, wouldn't necessarily mean the judge has to recuse. So the fact that a one-time client of this company was a party in the case by itself might not be enough, and I'd really need to know more.
Professor Jonathan Adler at Case Western Reserve University. Back to our first guest, Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor, legal correspondent at Slate.com. Elaborate on your earlier statement that President George W. Bush really changed the nature of the federal judiciary the way in which judges now interpret the Constitution.
Well, I think actually Professor Adler said it better than I. We are just at a moment in this country where there are two very, very different views of how we're going to set about this basic project of interpreting the Constitution. And I think one of the things that the Tea Party movement has been spectacularly successful at is really fanning the flames of this debate about what the Constitution means. And these foundational questions, Warren, about, you know, how are we going to go about doing this? Have we gotten off the rails? Have we been wrong since 1942, the decision in Wickard versus Filburn? That was the case, the Commerce Clause case, that everything kind of rises out of this question about whether you can sort of, the government can regulate you when you want to grow wheat for your own purposes, and that has sort of exploded into what I think Attorney General Cuccinelli would say is just decades of wrong-headed, expansive vision of the Commerce Clause. And I think that Professor Adler is also right to say that because this is a rather novel question, an application of the Commerce Clause, and because we don't have that many cases, we have under five, you know, major cases to talk about in the modern Supreme Court, there's just going to be an enormous amount of policy-based decision-making, a lot of judicial decision-making that says, you know, I just think that we've been doing this wrong for decades, and I think we've got to retrench and rethink what the Commerce Clause means. And this case is really ripe for that. I think that's one of the reasons it's been such a flashpoint. And the only other thing I would add is that George W. Bush did appoint one-third of the sitting federal judges now on the bench. And this is, you know, this is going to be a thumbprint of the Bush administration for generations to come, that there really is a profound difference, I think, in this country right now about how liberals and conservatives look at the Constitution. And this case, I think, really is a perfect storm in that it gathers up all of those differences, these very, very deep, really philosophical and policy differences, and throws it up in the air and says, what's going to happen in Anthony Kennedy's head?
And this has happened very quickly. As we just heard, the conventional wisdom now is that the court will divide four on each side, with Justice Kennedy the likely one to ultimately make the decision. Very recently, you and others thought that this was no deal. The Supreme Court was not going to approve these challenges to health care reform.
That's exactly right. I think it was the New York Times that initially made that point on Monday, and I think the Wall Street Journal made it very quickly after, just that if you had asked most court watchers, most sort of conventional court watchers last March when these challenges were filed, I think they were handicapping this, you know, 8-1, maybe 7-2 to uphold the Obama health care plan. That even Justice Scalia, if you look at his vote in the medicinal marijuana case, the recent medicinal marijuana case, would have no problem with this view of the Commerce Clause. And so I think that very, very quickly there was a sense that a lawsuit that a lot of people, including me, said, this is, you know, this is a Hail Mary. I mean, this is a real attempt to get in and make some constitutional point, but it doesn't have a lot of foundation in the court's jurisprudence. I think it very quickly started to look like an open question, and certainly now the handicapping seems to be this is going to be a 4-4, very likely be a 4-4 split at the court, with Justice Kennedy tipping the balance one way or another, and that happened remarkably fast.
And in that medical marijuana case, the Supreme Court approved the idea of an expansive federal authority over that substance nationwide.
That's right. And you know, in addition, I think Professor Adler made a really important point about there are issues that Judge Hudson didn't fully flesh out. Another one, in addition to the necessary and proper clause, there's a standing question about whether Virginia has standing to sue. He didn't really address that. So I want to be clear that because there's a lot of lawsuits that are happening around the country, they're going to go up through the appeals courts. We think right now we know what this case is going to be about when it lands at the Supreme Court. It may not. It It may be a standing matter. It may be a lot of other things. And so it's early days, and I think I want to caution your listeners that we can't read too much into three federal court decisions that have happened in the past few months.
Well, not when there are all these other ones pending. And as you say, other judges may find other issues to raise, and that could change the whole judicial situation, I gather, is what you're saying. Let me go back to David Sirota. Dahlia Lithwick, Jonathan Adler are both attorneys. Neither you nor I is an attorney. But what do you think about what's been said, particularly about by Dahlia Lithwick just now, about the success of the Tea Party, about this sudden realization that George W. Bush, having appointed a third of the sitting judges around the country, may in fact have had a drastic impact, and Jonathan Adler said the same thing, on the way cases are decided and the way government is structured?
Well, I think it's something that is entirely accurate. I think the Tea Party folks have reminded us that grassroots politics can have a real impact on our legislature, and I think that we are being reminded now that that elections have consequences. Previous elections have consequences. The Bush elections had consequences. This has been happening for some time, and I think that both of them are exactly right. That oftentimes the thumbprint, as it was called, of an administration lasts well past an administration through the judiciary. This, of course, will argue. This will be an argument that will be used, frankly, in the upcoming election by President Obama, who will go to liberals and who will say, "Listen, forget about all the policy matters that you disagreed with me on. Forget that I violated X or Y campaign promise. You have to reelect me because if you don't reelect me, I won't be able to put that lasting thumbprint on the judiciary in the future." It's basically saying that we are learning a lesson now about what kinds of legacy can be instilled in the federal judiciary well after an administration goes forward. So I think it's going to become an argument that actually Barack Obama uses to make to his own base to try to rekindle some of the enthusiasm for him from the base.
Jonathan Adler, back to you again to Case Western Reserve University. You, I gather, are a strict constructionist, one of those who is concerned about the attention of the framers. What about the role of the courts and the function that they have played recently in such decisions as the Civil Rights Act, the Clean Water Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act? And are the courts getting more power than the Congress?
I don't think the courts are getting more power than the Congress, but I think, as we've known really since the nation's founding, and as John Marshall reminded us in Marbury versus Madison, but as we knew when the Constitution was ratified, one of the jobs of a federal judge is to look at a statute when it is challenged or when it is implicated in a case, and to hold it up against the Constitution and to see whether or not they are consistent. And if they are not, the superior law, that is the Constitution, must prevail. And that means that in a whole wide range of areas, there are things that we may want to do, that we may think are important for the country, but that we can't do, or that at least we can't do in certain ways. And that's true in national security. It's true in law enforcement. There are things that we don't let the Transportation Security Administration do, or that we don't let police do when they are investigating a crime. And there are things that we don't let the Environmental Protection Agency, or in this case, the Department of Health and Human Services, do when they are trying to protect the health, safety, and welfare of Americans. And I think both left and right tend to ignore the constitutional limits on the things that they most like. The right tends to ignore them when it comes to national security or law enforcement. The left tends to ignore them when it comes to various types of social or environmental or health-related interventions. But in all those cases, I believe it is the job of judges to take seriously the words of the Constitution and to legislation or other government action clearly goes beyond the bounds of those words to say so and to rule accordingly. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times we're faced with tough cases. And in a case like this, the precise meaning of the necessary and proper clause, what is it for a piece of legislation to be both necessary and proper to carry into execution another of the federal government's power? Well, there's some ambiguity about that. And as a consequence, people of goodwill and good faith are going to disagree. And especially when we don't have lots of case law or lots of experience with the question, it's something that we have to struggle with and debate, and that judges are gonna try and resolve to the best of their ability, and hopefully we'll gain some clarity over time as a result of that.
So, Dahlia Lithwick, what we're seeing here, it seems to me, as you indicated, is something that's really basic to the way the Constitution causes the government to the three branches of government to a function, which would seem arcane and abstract under a lot of circumstances. But in this case, it involves something extraordinarily intimate for every citizen, and that is health care.
That's exactly right. And I think that one of the concerns that Judge Hudson raised in the Virginia ruling, where he talked about it, was what's the limiting principle here? In other words, if the government can force me, who is just alive, to go out and purchase health insurance, what else can they force me to do? And he sort of lists this slippery slope of, you know, can they force me to run out and purchase a car? And I think one of the things that is really interesting about this conversation, you know, Attorney General Cuccinelli yesterday said, is the government going to be able to force you to eat asparagus? You know, so I think there is this, and, you know, Cuccinelli has been very, very careful to frame this in terms of liberty and liberty and liberty, right? And he cites Patrick Henry in his briefs, and he cites 18th century case law. So I do think that this is really kind of drawing a straight line between a certain vision of liberty as, you know, as they construe it and the framers and how the framers perceive liberty, and then this sense that, you know, we're living in this terrifying nanny state, and that if Obama can make you buy health insurance, he's, you know, it's a short hop to the Brussels sprouts. And I think that that's just, you know, one of the things that the Obama administration is going to need to think about going forward, I think, defending the health care plan, is how do we articulate what the limiting principle is. But I think that your point about, you know, this seems like a very intimate issue, and I think that it really does go to this notion that people are feeling, and the Tea Party is so kind of founded in the notion that our privacy and liberty are being eroded by this administration, and that there is no limiting principle here.
Remember, George H.W. Bush didn't like broccoli. You wonder what kind of judges he would have appointed if he thought broccoli was the was the deciding factor. Really interesting conversation. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Dahlia Lithwick, again, senior editor, legal correspondent at Slate.com. David Sirota, nationally syndicated newspaper columnist, host of radio program on AM 760 in Denver. Jonathan Adler, professor of law, director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University, contributor to the National Review and the Volokh Conspiracy legal blog. And our earlier guest, Ezra Klein, columnist with Washington Post and Newsweek magazine. Thanks again to all of you for being with us today. On Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, store owners are learning Chinese. When Bond Street in London runs out of pounds, shops accept renminbi. In a moment, we'll hear how the People's Republic is changing the luxury markets worldwide on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Carl Gerth is professor of Chinese history at Oxford University. He's the author of a new book called As China Goes, So Goes the World, How Chinese Consumers Are Transforming Everything. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the luxury market. You're the one who said that in Bond Street, the shops there are accepting a Chinese currency when they run out of pounds. And the New York Times reported that the shops in Rodeo Drive are having to learn Chinese. How important are the Chinese consumers? What does this mean to the luxury market worldwide?
Well, just 10 years ago, China was an infinitesimally small part of the luxury market around the world. They consume something like the 1% of the top luxury brands. In just 10 years, they've gone from 1% to something like 20%. They've even passed the United States, which is at around 17%, and they're gaining on Japan, where they're expected to pass them by 2015. So, yeah, they're already a very important player when it comes to luxury goods. The problem is that there's a perception in China that, one, the luxury goods there are fake, two, they're probably taxed much higher, and three, maybe the best quality, latest stuff isn't there. So you see large numbers of Chinese tourists, well-heeled Chinese tourists, on all these major shopping streets around the world, snapping up the latest and best stuff in mass quantities.
Lest one think of China as a communist nation, obviously there is an enormous difference in and divergence in the and who's got the money and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big problem in China, and it's sometimes hard for people to remember that China is simultaneously a very rich country with among the most billionaires in the world, but also a country with hundreds of millions of desperately poor people. So on the one hand, you'll have some of the most fashionable people driving the best cars, eating the most expensive food, and so on. On the other hand, you'll have people living in desperate poverty.
With regard to the luxury goods, are they buying them from themselves, for themselves, rather, or are they buying them to resell?
Some of both. One of the things I like about studying Chinese markets is that they seem to find markets where we might overlook them. One of these areas is to send people over and to have them buy as many as they can, bring them back in, and then resell them once they get back to China.
In what other ways are Chinese consumers transforming everything, to go back to the title of your book?
That's a good question. I think in order to defend that subtitle as more than publisher's hyperbole, I had to think of it everything from the biosphere. In other words, Chinese starting to drive as many cars or more cars. They became the number one car market, passing the U.S. last year in 2009. So they're also the number one carbon emitter. So on the one hand, they're changing the biosphere. On the other hand, I think they're changing their own consciousness by going from a society without many brands to a society dominated by brands. I think in our modern society, we create our own identity by buying branded items and communicating that identity through brands. Let me give you an example. If you have a Timex, as I have, or if you have a Rolex, you're sending a signal about who you are to people that is very different from one another. I think that as Chinese begin to see themselves in this way through branded products, they change their subjective experience of the world. So I would say everything ranges from, again, the globe that we live in to Chinese consciousness about brands to our own consciousness about brands. I also argue that the Chinese are going to participate in not only buying all of these expensive brands, but also creating brands of their own. So I wouldn't be surprised if someday, rather than using Google, you use Baidu, to cite one example.
What about the issue of, you mentioned earlier, of people being suspicious about the quality of what they're getting and thinking that things might be faked? What sort of regulations does China have to govern that kind of what's the word,
Intellectual property rights.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you. That will help.
Well, it's an important question. If you go back to what I just mentioned about our contemporary consciousness being built around brands, what happens when the brands you buy aren't what you think they are? If you've paid $1,000 or a couple thousand or whatever a Rolex costs and you find out that it's fake, or that your friends think it's a fake, they can't be sure that it's the real thing, then maybe you aren't able to create the identity that you want to create. That's a pretty big problem in China. I mean, if you follow even passingly news coming out of China, you'll notice that in the United States and elsewhere, there are all these stories of counterfeits or shoddy goods turning up that are emanating out of China. Well, imagine the situation within China as being infinitely worse. The problem for the government is that it's of two minds. On the one hand, as it begins to have more intellectual property of its own to protect, it has a vested interest in protecting that. There's no way that they're going to be able to build domestically and internationally competitive brands to compete against McDonald's, Coke, Google, and so on if they don't protect intellectual property. On the other hand, there are parts of China, there are counties in China whose entire economies are dependent on the production of counterfeit brands. So it's a big problem. You could also say that it helps jumpstart the luxury market, that some of these counterfeits allow people to consume and enjoy things, even poorly made knockoffs that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. So in some ways, it feeds consumerism.
How do Chinese billionaires get to be billionaires, and how does so many others get to have at least enough money that they can travel all over the world and buy Hermes and Chanel?
That's a very contentious question in China. I think the Chinese have a love-hate relationship with their wealthy, much more intense than what we see here in the United States. On the one hand, they want to emulate those lifestyles. Who wouldn't want to have several large houses, nice cars, vacations in warm locations in winter, and so on? But on the other hand, there's a perception that a lot of the people that are the most wealthy in China got that way because of government connections. There's a growing number of millions of underemployed or unemployed college-educated people that feel like they're being locked out of the good life. I think that's going to create a lot of social tension, or continue to create a lot of social tension in China. Who gets to consume all of these wonderful things? Who gets to go to Rodeo Drive and buy as many LV handbags as they can grab before they run out?
And what's the impact on the economy in Europe, and particularly, of course, the economy in the United States?
I think we're only beginning to understand the huge impact of this. But again, if you read any page of the business section these days, there's usually a story on China and U.S.-based multinationals, whether it's Starbucks planning to open 1,500 stores in China in the next 4 years, or it's The Gap or any of these other U.S.-based or European-based brands that are all looking towards the Chinese consumer to save their bottom lines.
Carl Gerth, again, a Harvard PhD, now professor of Chinese history at Oxford University. His book, As China Goes, So Goes the World, How Chinese Consumers Are Transforming Everything. Thanks so much. Today's program was produced by Gary Scott with Christian Bordahl and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Mike Newport, managing producer Karen Radziner. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. Check us out on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.